They're certainly still above average in their musicality. And as they grow up and disperse around the world, leaving Lake Wobegon behind, they remain persistently, universally the best. The confidence artist will do everything in his power to bring our better-than-averageness front and center. Grifters appeal to our vanity. Not about just anything, but about the things that are most central for us. After all, they've spent the entire put-up casing our psychology. How intelligent you are, Professor Frampton. Just what I want in a man. So intellectually stellar that my looks are a perfect complement.
What a savvy investor you are, Mr. Koufax. What a great judge of character, Mr. Barrett.
The tale centers on our singular talents. And we believe it. Not because it's plausible. A supermodel is on a dating site and she targets me? But because we want it to be. The more exceptional we see ourselves, the easier we may be to con. As one grifter, a player of the short con known as the tat, played with a crooked die that has fives on four sides and sixes on two, and is subbed in at the last moment for an identical but fair one, told David Moore, "A New Yorker is the best sucker that ever was born. He is made to order for anything. You can't knock him. He loves to be taken because he's wise." Because New Yorkers fancy themselves so cosmopolitan and sophisticated, they are the easiest fish to catch. The tale tells itself. It's how so many con artists justify their actions to themselves, getting swept up in their own stories so strongly that they forget, at least for a moment, that they are lying. The belief in exceptionalism, after all, applies just as much to the con artist as to the mark. I am allowed to act like this because I am an exception to society's rules. In one of his escapades, our old friend Demora took on the role of Ben W. Jones, a proper Southern gentleman who had decided to turn his eye to crime in the guise of a prison warden in Texas. The Texas penal system has never been known for its leniency, and its potential guards are no exception. Prior to being hired, Demora was asked to provide references from his three last employers, as well as personal references from eight different acquaintances. You'd think that such a burden of proof would scare him off. But no, Demora inhabited his role so completely that he sincerely believed it was rightfully his, and everything would work out. And after it did work out, Demora himself helpfully supplied the majority of the references. His belief in his exceptionality, that even here he would not be caught, is what led to his downfall. So invulnerable did he think himself that he handed one of the inmates the very Time magazine where he'd first been profiled, picture and all. The prisoner promptly reported the rise of the imposter, and B.W. Jones was quietly dismissed. The same "I'm the exception" reasoning applies across all types of schemes. It's true of people from Jonah Lehrer to Lance Armstrong, Michael Shermer points out. Lehrer's mea culpa was a bit like Lance's Oprah moment, not much of a moment at all. There is no sense of guilt, but rather a sense of entitlement followed by a regret at getting caught. People like Stephen Glass and Jonah Lehrer are just smaller, less harmful versions of Madoff, but still in the same category. Like Lance said, "All cyclists dope in that circuit. I got caught, whatever. That's the only thing he's sorry about." Prison did not agree with Frampton. He had a lung condition that left him coughing amidst the smoke-filled air, and an elevated blood pressure that the stress of cell life did little to alleviate. But, he said, although it was a very dehumanizing experience to be in prison, adding that he and his fellow inmates were treated like cattle, he was staying creative, using the computer at Villa Devoto to continue with his research and follow field developments, like the Higgs boson discovery. He continued to post works in progress on ArXiv, an internet repository of preprints in mathematical and scientific fields. Over the phone, he persisted in supervising two graduate students. He even found time to referee some journal articles. In October 2012, Frampton was allowed to leave the prison and instead spent his days under house arrest at an old friend's home.
His lawyers had convinced the judge that his lung condition was too dire and ever worsening in the Villa Devoto cells. UNC, meanwhile, suspended his $106,835 annual salary. Frampton appealed. Over 80 professors signed a letter in support of his case, calling it a threat to the tenure system everywhere. The suspension remained in place. The trial lasted for 3 days. Piece by piece, the prosecution laid out the evidence against Frampton, and his situation began to seem ever more dire. There were the texts with Denise. He worried about sniffer dogs. He was taking care of the special little suitcase. In Bolivia, this is worth nothing. In Europe, it's worth millions, one text to his beloved read. Another, Monday arrival changed. You must not tell the coca goons. Another, need to know if your loyalty is with the bad guy, agent, and Bolivian friends, or good guy, your husband. Frampton explained them away as jokes. In retrospect, jokes in poor taste, but in the moment, fairly hilarious, he said. Besides, he had been severely sleep-deprived. Then there was the back-of-the-napkin calculation about the drug's street value. But he'd only written it out after he'd been detained, he argued. He was prone to calculating everything in his line of sight. On November 21st, 2012, nearly a year after he was first arrested, Frampton was found guilty of drug smuggling and sentenced to 56 months in prison. "I'm in a state of shock and disbelief," he told the Raleigh News and Observer a day after the sentence. "This is a gross miscarriage of justice. If this had happened in the U.S., a jury would have obviously acquitted me." Soon after the sentence, he received further bad news. The provost of UNC at the time, Bruce Carney, told him that he was going to be fired. Frampton requested a hearing from the faculty hearing committee. Why did Frampton persist in believing that he deserved an exception? Why did he appear to be so seemingly oblivious to things that, to an outside observer, seemed nothing short of overtly incriminating? Could he truly believe his actions would be taken for a practical joke, and then expect the university to bend its rules and let him keep his position? What seems like sheer stupidity at best, and more likely willful ignorance, is actually quite understandable in the moment. The power of the tale isn't the strength of its logic. It's that at the point it's told, we're past being reasonable. The superiority bias doesn't just make us more vulnerable to tales that seem rather tall to an objective eye. It colors how we then evaluate evidence and make decisions. In one early study, Ziva Kunda, a psychologist who devoted her career to motivated cognition, the process by which our views of the world are motivated by our own self-serving, better-than-average biases and perception, found that when personal outcomes were at stake, people's ability to reason logically went out the window. When she had students read descriptions of individuals who were either like them or not, their predictions of their likelihood of personal and professional success vacillated strongly. The more similar the person, the less objectively the students weighed the evidence, skewing in favor of a positive outcome, a successful marriage, a stellar academic career, even when it didn't seem warranted. The students, concluded Kunda, were interpreting the world with what she termed the self-serving bias. That bias, moreover, didn't just manifest itself in hypothetical predictions. In another study, Kunda gave students an article about the risks caffeine consumption posed for the development of fibrocystic disease in women. She told them it was from the New York Times science section, but had really taken it from a medical journal, where its findings had later been disputed by other researchers. She then asked them to rate their own risk for developing the disease within 15 years and to evaluate how convincing they found the article itself. A curious pattern soon emerged. Women who were heavy or moderate caffeine drinkers themselves acknowledged that they might be at higher risk, but were also far more skeptical of the article. They wanted, they said, to see some additional evidence. To them, the study seemed shaky at best. Everyone else, however, men and women who drank little or no caffeine, found the work convincing. So what does this suggest? Simply put, when it comes to ourselves, our traits, our lives, our decisions, our personal attachment overshadows our objective knowledge. We systematically misevaluate evidence based on our own characteristics, and if we're given evidence that something about us poses a threat, instead of thinking about how to change our own behavior, we call the evidence itself into question. To put this in conning terms, if I paint a picture of a perfect mark for you, and you recognize yourself in it, you are more likely to think I'm a poor researcher than yourself a good target. Nah, you'll say. Those aren't actually the things that get someone conned. I bet this girl didn't do any research and is just constructing this out of thin air. Frampton's texts look beyond incriminating in retrospect. But at the time, I'm not generally the suspicious type, he told the Telegraph. So although it seems very odd in retrospect, even to me, it all seemed perfectly plausible to me at the time. I really did not suspect anything was wrong until I was arrested. This is less far-fetched than it may at first appear. We don't see objectively. We see the version that best suits our own desires. And because the tale is all about telling us how we'll personally benefit, it is in many ways the easiest part of the confidence game to stomach. We're on the exact same page as the grifter. We deserve this. When Frampton evaluated his chances of success with Milani, he looked past the fact that he had never met her, that she seemed to vanish every time he got close, that he was dealing with an unsavory character instead of his sweet bride-to-be. Instead, he focused on the texts of love and adoration, the photographs, the vision of the future. In that haze, any signs of drug-related banter were simply that, banter. Because of our self-serving bias, we tend to rationalize after the fact, focusing on reasons that justify our choice rather than those that went against it. It's a kind of confirmation in reverse. We want to decide to do one thing over another, take the suitcase for Denise, and we want to think our decision good. This is what a good husband does. So we marshal evidence that makes our decision seem well-reasoned, even when we didn't actually use any of that evidence in reaching our choice to begin with. There's nothing wrong with this suitcase. It's perfectly normal to carry an empty bag for a girl you've never met that was given to you by a man in a dark Bolivian street. She has always joked with me, so the cocaine texts are jokes. And I want her to like me and think that I'm cool and with it and able to play along. The woman of my dreams would never actually hurt me. Oh, and if she were out to get me? I'm a brilliant man. I would know. And I know real love when I see it. Real love would not actually give me cocaine. So I'll text away. After all, there's no actual danger. And she will be even more fond of me when she sees how playful I can be. I may be older than she, but I can be hip and lighthearted with the best of them. I will pass her every test. Paul Slovic's work centers on how we make decisions, especially under conditions of risk. That is, when we're taking some sort of gamble, be it financial or personal. He proposes that when we want to go for something for whatever reason, the reasons in support of the choice will loom much heavier than those against it. If, however, we want to reject it, the negatives will suddenly seem much meatier. We focus on the rationale that retroactively justifies our choice rather than actually base our choice in the moment on the most pertinent rationale. If Frampton had found Denise unattractive, he would have likely evaluated her identical dating profile much more negatively. He might have even called it a scam, one of many so-called sweetheart cons that line the pages of dating services. He would have said he was basing his conclusion on the evidence, when he was doing no such thing. He would have already decided he didn't like her, and so would be looking for reasons to justify that conclusion. Even after he'd been in prison, Frampton remained unconvinced of Denise's duplicity. For months, the New York Times reported, he held that they had both been set up. When he first called me, He thought he'd be home in a couple of days, Anne Marie Frampton told the Telegraph. It would all turn out to be a big misunderstanding, he assumed. She, however, was more alarmed. Not mincing words, she summed up the situation this way. I realize that for somebody who doesn't know Paul, it must seem crazy that someone could be both so intelligent and so devoid of common sense. Even his friends would tell you that he's completely daft. He's a naive fool. He is really an idiot savant. She concluded, his stupidity could cost him his life. One of the reasons that the tale is so powerful is that, despite the motivated reasoning that we engage in, we never realize we're doing it. We think we are being rational, even if we have no idea why we're really deciding to act that way. In Telling More Than We Can Know, a seminal paper in the history of social and cognitive psychology, Richard Nisbet and Timothy Wilson showed that people's decisions are often influenced by minute factors outside their awareness. But tell them as much, and they rebel. Instead, they will give you a list of well-reasoned justifications for why they acted as they did. The real reasons, however, remain outside their knowledge. In fact, even when Nisbet and Wilson pinpointed the precise inspiration for a choice, in one case someone casually walking by a curtain to make it swing back and forth in a manner that suggested the swing of a pendulum, prompting the subject herself to swing a rope as a pendulum to solve a puzzle, the vast majority of people persisted in a faulty interpretation. It wasn't the power of suggestion, they insisted. It was an insight they had reached after meticulous thought and evaluation of alternatives. In the 1970s, a new kind of art started to gain traction in the New York art market, 19th century American painting. The paintings had existed for over a century, to be sure, but they had never been particularly popular. Suddenly, they were all the rage. By the end of the decade, they were commanding prices in the hundreds of thousands, selling at auctions at the best houses and gracing the walls of the chicest art collectors. The art world is notoriously fickle. Trends come and go. Artists sold for nothing become popular. Artists who were popular sell for nothing. But in this particular case, part of the market wasn't altogether accidental. It was, rather, the doing of an incredibly successful confidence man and one who was master of the tale, if ever there were. Ken Perini feels no guilt about his past as a fine art forger who duped galleries, collectors, and auction houses alike into buying his faux 19th century creations. He's downright gleeful. I loved what I did, he tells me one winter afternoon, sitting in his Florida living room. It was a contest of wits. I regret nothing. Well, the only regret I have in my life is that the FBI walked in on me. One of the things he's most proud of is his ability, with a few accomplices, to convince people that a Butterworth is exactly what they'd been wanting for their collection all along. It was the ground floor of a rapidly developing new market, Perini recalls. No one knew quite what to expect, or quite what they wanted. So Perini was all too happy to plant the seeds of suggestion, and then create the perfect painting to make that suggestion a reality, all the while letting the gallery owner or collector think he was the one calling the shots, asking for the precise painting he wanted, playing Perini for the fool by extracting a good deal on the price. By 1978, the Sotheby's catalog contained two full-page prints of Butterworth paintings that would be up for sale. Both were hot commodities, the 19th century sweet spot, and both had been painted in the last few years by Perini. Perini was never formally charged. After the FBI caught up with him, he was eventually let off with a warning not to do it again. He now paints legitimate forgeries, that is, the same fakes, but without passing them off as such. He doesn't know why, but he suspects it would be too embarrassing for the major auction houses. The 19th century American painting department is the jewel in the crown of Sotheby's. They started it, they developed it, it had never been tainted by any scandal, he speculates. If my story came out, they would have to say, oh my God, how deep does this go? How many did he sell? Perini didn't just enter the market. He helped create it, convincing Marks of what they'd always wanted, and then nicely filling that request. Because don't they deserve the best? Not only does our conviction of our own exceptionalism and superiority make us misinterpret events and mischaracterize decisions, it also hits us a second time, long after the event in question. Because of this, we rewrite the past in a way that makes us less likely to learn from it, selectively recalling everything good and conveniently forgetting the bad. We rewrite positive events to make us more central in their unfolding. As for negative events, sometimes we don't even remember they occurred. In other words, someone like Frampton, after being released, will likely fail to learn something about the future from his behavior in the past. Memory is a tricky thing, and once we've been taken once, it becomes all the more likely that we will fall for a con again. There is no better mark, many a con artist will tell you, than one who has already been duped. When Bluma Zeigarnik, a psychologist from the Gestalt School, discovered her eponymous effect, we remember interrupted tasks better than completed ones, our minds haven't quite given up working on them, and we feel a strong need to attain some sort of closure. She also noted a far less frequently cited exception. As it turns out, we don't remember all uninterrupted tasks equally. Zeigarnik found that for some people, the effect was reversed. If a person felt she had performed poorly, the task was promptly dismissed from the mind. The privileged position reserved for unfinished business was no longer so privileged if the business in question wasn't a particularly good one. For a con artist, that tendency is pure gold. You will try your best to dismiss any moments when you acted like a dupe, rationalize them away as flukes. So next time the tale rolls around, you will once more think it's your lucky chance. In 1943, Saul Rosenzweig, a psychologist at Clark University and Worcester State Hospital, further elaborated on Zeigarnik's exception. What if, he wondered, he took it one step further, an interrupted task that signaled personal failure, whereas simple completion would mean success? Rosenzweig recruited a group of students to complete a series of jigsaw puzzles, pictures of everyday objects like a boat, a house, or a bunch of grapes, each the size of a square foot. Each student would be allowed to complete only half of them. The other half, as in Zeigarnik's prior setups, would be interrupted. Not all the puzzle-completing sessions, however, transpired in quite the same way. In one case, Rosenzweig had recruited students from the Student Employment Office for a small hourly fee. These students were told that they'd be evaluating puzzles for a future study. What the researchers were interested in was figuring out how well the puzzles worked for the purposes of their research. This is not in any way a test of your ability or anything else about you, each student was explicitly told. Don't hurry or feel in any way constrained. And one more thing. Do not be surprised if I interrupt you before you finish, he said. I doubtless shall do so if I find out what I want to know about a particular puzzle before you finish. The other group, however, was set up for an altogether different experience. This time, they weren't recruited by just anyone. They were the freshman advisees of the director of the clinic, and he personally invited each of them to take part. This time around, the puzzles were presented as a test of intelligence, so that you may be compared with the other persons taking the test. Each puzzle would count the same in the final score, but different puzzles had different levels of difficulty, and so the time allowed to work on each would vary. If you do not solve any puzzle in the allotted time, I shall naturally be obliged to stop you. And one more thing. Your work will be interpreted as representing the full extent of your ability. So do your best. As if they weren't going to already. Immediately after the last puzzle, each student in the study was asked to list as many of the puzzles as he could remember, in any order they occurred to him. When Rosenzweig compared the lists, he found exactly what he had hypothesized. The first group exhibited just the expected Zeigarnik effect. Their recall of the interrupted puzzles far exceeded their recall of the completed ones. In the second group, however, the effect was completely reversed. Now memory for the completed task surpassed recall of the interrupted ones by a long shot. It was, Rosenzweig concluded, a battle of excitement and pride. Excitement on working on something in the first case, and pride at finishing in the second. Despite the shaky ethical standards adhered to in social experimentation in 1943, the poor students in the second group were promptly debriefed to disclose the true nature of the study. They did not leave feeling that their intellect had taken a sudden plunge. Cons are often underreported because, to the end, the marks insist they haven't been conned at all. Our memory is selective. When we feel that something was a personal failure, we dismiss it rather than learn from it. And so, many marks decide that they were merely victims of circumstance. They had never been taken for a fool. In June 2014, a so-called suckers list of people who had fallen for multiple scams surfaced in England. It had been passed on from shady group to shady group, sold to willing bidders until law enforcement had gotten hold of its content. It was 160,000 names long. When authorities began contacting some of the individuals on the list, they were met with surprising resistance. "I've never been scammed," the victims insisted. "You must have the wrong information." Of course, it's not particularly pleasant to dwell on moments that put our skills or personalities in question. We'd much rather pretend they never happened. And even if we do remember, we're much more likely to shift some of the blame in other directions. The test was rigged and unfair. It was her fault. He was being mean. She didn't give me a chance. He asked for it. I was tired, hungry, stressed, overwhelmed, thirsty, bored, worried, preoccupied, unlucky. Unfortunately, by this kind of dismissal, we fail to learn what we could have done differently. And in the case of the con, we fail to properly assess our risk of getting, well, conned. We fall for the tale because we want to believe its promise of personal gain and don't much feel like recalling any reasons why that promise may be more smoke and mirrors than anything else. In fact, Baruch Fischhoff, a social psychologist at Carnegie Mellon who studies how we make decisions, even has a name for instances of past misdirection: the knew-it-all-along effect, or, as it's more commonly known, hindsight bias. I knew it was a scam the whole time, so the fact that I don't think that this scheme is a scam now speaks all the more highly for its integrity. The confidence man need not even convince us by this point. We're quite good at getting over that hurdle ourselves. We don't see what the evidence says we should see. We see what we expect to see. As Princeton University psychologist Susan Fiske puts it, instead of a naive scientist entering the environment in search of the truth, we find the rather unflattering picture of a charlatan trying to make the data come out in a manner most advantageous to his or her already held theories. That charlatan isn't the con artist who's out there. That charlatan is us conning ourselves. Alas, our belief in our own superiority persists in the most unfortunate and ironic of places, in our assessment of the extent to which we believe in our own superiority. Of course, we realize that some things are simply too good to be true. There is no such thing as a free lunch, and any number of other clichés we bandy about for just this purpose. We understand this in general. And yet, the illusion of unique invulnerability to all those biases is a tough one to break. We never think that, in any specific instance, it applies to us. In 1986, Linda Perloff and Barbara Fetzer, psychologists at the University of Illinois at Chicago, published the results of a series of studies aimed at testing how our beliefs in our own personal vulnerability may differ from our beliefs about vulnerability more broadly. Over and over, they found, people tended to underestimate the extent to which they were susceptible to any bad turn in life. Their risks were reliably lower than the risk of the average person, at least according to their own estimate. When Perloff and Fetzer tried to get their subjects to adjust their estimates by changing the comparison point from average to someone they knew, say a friend or family member, in the hopes of making the risks seem more concrete, the attempt unexpectedly backfired. It didn't make them feel more vulnerable at all. Instead, it made them think that their friends and family were similarly less vulnerable. Sure, it could happen in general, but it won't happen to me or my friends and family. In other words, instead of adjusting their own risk, their overconfidence widened to enfold the others in their lives. Whenever we have an opening to do so, the authors concluded, we will compare downward. That is, we will place ourselves and those closest to us at lower risk than the abstract mass of others, whether that risk is for a heart attack or a crime. This is true of just about every better-than-average effect. When it comes to our friends, our relatives, our coworkers, even complete strangers, we tend to be fairly good at spotting biases even as we miss them completely in ourselves. In one set of studies, Stanford University students and random travelers at the San Francisco airport were shown to be capable of evaluating the susceptibility of the average American or their fellow students to a range of subjective evaluations. But when it came to themselves, they remained completely blind. Completely, and it seemed almost willfully, much like Frampton or de Vedrine. Even when the experimenters described the bias and pointed out that people tended to weigh themselves more positively on positive attributes and less than average on negative ones, the overwhelming majority insisted their initial rating was accurate, and 13% went even further to say they'd been too modest. Others see the world through a prism of subjectivity. My view, however, is accurate. I'm fairly good at being objective, if I may say so myself. In the summer of 2014, I had the chance to speak to a rather unusual family, one in which two grown siblings had, completely independently, gotten conned, trapped in schemes that had little to do with each other. Dave was the victim of an unfortunate ticket exchange on Craigslist. Unable to go to a show, he posted an ad looking to exchange his tickets for another evening. A few days later, he received a reply. Ashley was willing to exchange, but she, unfortunately, had e-tickets. Trying to protect himself from getting scammed, he had asked for paper tickets only. Dave was a bit worried, but no one else had offered to trade, and he really wanted to go to the show. And Ashley seemed legitimate. A quick Google search revealed a LinkedIn profile and a valid-seeming, upstanding occupation. They went ahead with the switch. Everything seemed good, up until the moment he and his girlfriend got to the show. Their e-tickets had already been scanned, the guard informed them. They had been the victims of a well-known ticket fraud, where one person legitimately buys electronic tickets, but then proceeds to sell them to multiple buyers. Meanwhile, on the other coast, Dave's sister Debbie found herself out some $50 after buying bogus magazine subscriptions from a man who'd come to her door with a tale of trial and redemption. He had been in prison and was now working his way toward a better life. She hadn't wanted to buy a subscription, she didn't need any more magazines, but his story and his mention of the tax deduction she'd receive swayed her. She had pledged to be more charitable, and here was a good deed that would make her a kinder person. When she later checked up on the organization, its website had disappeared. The magazines, of course, never arrived. Both fairly innocuous, small-stakes cons. Except for one thing, the siblings could spot the scam and the gullibility a mile away when it came to each other's stories. When it came to themselves, though, they were certain in the moment that they were the exception. Sure, Dave knew all about Craigslist scams, but he really wanted to go to the show, and the chances of him personally falling for a scam were slim to none. He had been careful. Debbie, however, would never buy e-tickets from a stranger. How silly could you be? Sure, Debbie knew that there were many imposters claiming false hardship for easy cash, but she wanted to donate more to worthy causes, and his story seemed on the level. The chances of her personally falling for someone who wasn't sincere were slim to none. Dave, however, would have done his due diligence before he parted with any cash. How trusting could you be? When it comes to you, I see clearly. When it comes to myself, I see what I want. Marie Jehoda, Mitzi as she was known, had a nose for prejudice. She had to. A Jew born in Vienna in the winter of 1907, she found herself in prison in 1936. Not yet for her Jewishness, Austria was yet to be annexed by Hitler, but for her political views as a social democrat. She managed to escape and make her way to London. Her first book, however, which had expounded on her research to date, was rounded up and most of its copies summarily burned, this time because its author was Jewish. When she made it to the United States and was teaching at NYU, she focused not only on mental health, but also on social prejudice. And there she came to a very different conclusion from her earlier view that an accurate perception of reality was a prerequisite of solid mental health. People with prejudices seldom like to admit it, she wrote in one study of opinion researchers who had themselves used biased questions to detect bias in others. What she then failed to deduce was it wasn't just anti-Semitism that they didn't like to admit. If you can't see one shortcoming, chances are you don't accurately see any, or at least many of them. If you tell someone they are prejudiced, they will laugh in your face and give you all the reasons why they aren't. If you tell people they aren't superior in all the ways they think themselves to be, that they aren't objective, aren't exceptional, and actually do exhibit many biases in their worldview, they will promptly dismiss what you've said. Or, to put it in other words, after listening to this chapter, you will be intrigued by all of these forays with exceptionalism, but you will remain convinced that you, personally, have already properly taken them into consideration. Your present understanding of yourself and of the world around you is now fairly objective. Everyone else, however, is a potential sucker. Cons work so widely because, in a sense, we want them to. We want to believe the tale, and we want to believe things that are too good to be true more than anything else. Cons aren't about money or about love. They are about our beliefs. We are savvy investors. We are discerning with our love interests. We have a stellar reputation. We are fundamentally people to whom good things happen with good reason. We live in a world full of wonder, not a world of uncertainty and negativity. We live in a world where good things happen to those who wait. The teller of the tale has us hooked. In August 1835, Sir John Herschel, son of the astronomer Sir William Herschel, made a remarkable discovery. Using the latest in telescoping technology, he had been able to view the moon in unprecedented detail. And what a view it was! Beaches of white sand, abutting lakes, and oceans of blue. Buffalo-like beasts wandering through lush forests over a rocky marbled path. There was, too, something disturbingly like a unicorn, with a single horn and a goat or horse-like appearance, but blue in color, and a beaver-like animal that walked as humans did, on 2 feet. And best of all, there were what seemed to be a species of human, batmen, with semi-transparent wings sprouting from their backs. Their lives, it seemed, were much like ours. Herschel had seen some bathing in the waters, shaking out their wings as ducks do theirs. He'd seen others sharing a meal, fruit from the wondrous trees. They seemed to be altogether happy, prosperous, and peaceful. Or so wrote Richard Adams Locke for the New York Sun as reported on Herschel's incredible findings. And incredible they were, in every sense of the word. The whole thing had been an elaborate hoax, planned over multiple installments to goad credulous readers. It worked better than expected. Not only did the news consumers fall for it completely, but so did the rest of the media. According to the New York Times, the story was probable and plausible. At Yale, students and professors alike discussed the news. And when it was revealed for what it was, a hoax, many refused to believe it. It wasn't a hoax. It was a conspiracy and a cover-up. The men existed, but when word got out, the government had moved to cover it up. It's an all-too-familiar course of events. Spectacular news, spectacularly covered, spectacularly accepted. At least in this case, it was an in-good-fun con without any real victims or repercussions. But the persistence with which readers clung to it despite its obvious outlandishness underscores the power that the aptly told tale has over our minds. Our world is an incredible place where incredible things happen. The secret of rulership, wrote George Orwell, is to combine a belief in one's own infallibility with the power to learn from past mistakes. The con artist has learned that. The rest of us would do well to catch up. Paul Frampton, in the end, was exceptional. In January 2015, 2 years and 6 months before his sentence would have been up, he was allowed to leave Buenos Aires for London, a luxury not afforded to many prisoners. He's currently seeking another academic appointment, if you happen to hear of anything. Chapter 6, The Convincer. I was the realization of their dreams, the idol, the hero, the master and arbiter of their lives. Charles Ponzi. In March 1889, William Franklin Miller asked a group of friends for an investment of $10. Affable and boyish-looking, coming in at just under 5.5 feet, with a touch of gravitas lent him by a dark mustache that framed a nose broken in some other life, Miller was a prominent member of the community, a congregant of the Tompkins Avenue Congregational Church, a leading church in Brooklyn, and past president of its charitable arm, the Christian Endeavor Society. It was there that he had met the three young men, Hartman, Bergstrom, and Brog, the youngest just turned 17, the oldest 20, to whom he now posed his plan. If they each gave him a tenner, he told them conspiratorially, he would make them a promise. Each week, they would receive a full 10% return on their stake. They huddled closer. 10% seemed an awfully large amount. Miller spoke in low tones. He had, he told the men, an in at the New York Stock Exchange. His inside information would allow him to not only guarantee the promised 10% return, but also to protect the initial investment through a mysterious surplus. Later, he would elaborate that his inside tips were from the fountainhead of speculative interests and never fail us. And any time they wanted to stop, well, all he needed was a week's notice, and they would receive all the money they'd placed with him, safe and sound. The men were intrigued. It seemed a bit too good to be true, yes. But then again, Miller was a trusted man. At 22, he had far more worldly experience than they. And he had been in the markets before. What he failed to mention was that it was as an office boy for Jacob A. Cantor, a job that paid him $5 a week. He even had that office, on the corner of Marcian Park, just above the Heber and Brandt store. Clearly, he could afford it. Who knows? Maybe he really did have an edge. They withdrew to think it over. On March 16th, Oscar Bergstrom arrived at 144 Floyd Street, Miller's new headquarters. Up a flight of stairs, into a room furnished sparsely but well. It was a former bedroom in the front hall. A desk strewn with important-looking financial papers. A small table, a handful of chairs. And, of course, a large, prominent safe. This was, after all, a place that saw real money. Miller greeted him alone. He was being careful with his funds and wasn't going to throw money away with needless overhead. This was a man to be trusted to be frugal and measured in his approach to your hard-earned currency. He would not frivolously waste it on things like an assistant. $10 in hand, Bergstrom approached the desk. With great care, Miller took the money. It would be safe with him, he assured the slightly anxious young man. In return, he gave him a small strip of paper. The money was received, it said, for speculation in stocks, the principal guaranteed against loss, dividends weekly from $1 upwards till principal is withdrawn. Miller had his first client. and he was true to his word. Each week through early April, Bergstrom made the trip to Floyd Street, and each week, as promised, he received his 10% return. Impressed, Bergstrom gave Miller a further $10. By August, business picking up, Miller hired a few extra hands. John and Lewis Miller and Charles Scherer, 14-year-old boys. He'd been a clerk himself, and now he was training others. By October, he'd taken over the entire house, and the house's owner, Gus Brandt, had become an investor. $20 in April, $100 in June, $10 more in August, another $50 to follow in November. The clients grew. Now, Miller wasn't handing out just any stray slips. He had letterhead. An investment of $10 will net you a profit of $52 a year, it read. And below, William F. Miller, Manager, Franklin Syndicate, Bankers and Brokers, Stock Exchange Daily from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. A picture of Ben Franklin adorned the page, with his wisdom imprinted below. The way to wealth is as plain as the road to market. By the late fall, his certificates were being professionally engraved, and he'd added investments, stocks, bonds, wheat, cotton to his qualifications. In October, his investments a runaway success, Miller decided to incorporate. Beginning December 2nd, he wrote his investors, his company would be officially known as the Franklin Syndicate and would be launched with an initial capital of $1 million. It was as much for their benefit and protection as his, he said. They could turn in their investment slips for stock certificates, and all who helped him would in turn be helping themselves. By March 1, 1900, he predicted, shares would be selling for between $400 and $500 each. Together, they would grow rich. Oh, and from now on, $50 was the minimum deposit. In conclusion, I desire to congratulate all those who have been depositors in the Franklin Syndicate on the wonderful success the Franklin has had under my management. The incorporation was taking a bit longer than expected. Unforeseen obstacles, you understand. Some of the investors began to express their impatience. But in short order, they were reminded that my intention is to make the Franklin Syndicate one of the largest and strongest syndicates operating on Wall Street, which will enable us to manipulate stocks, putting them up or down as we desire, and which will make our profits 5 times more than they are now. And as always, they were completely, utterly, totally guaranteed against any losses. Our business is honest, safe, legitimate, and profitable. To the doubters, he had only one thing to say. This may look almost impossible to you, but you know there must be a way where one can double their money in a short time, or else there would be no Jay Gould, Vanderbilt, or Flower Syndicate, and other millionaires and syndicates who made their fortune in Wall Street starting with almost nothing. He was right, of course. What about them? The impatient investors calmed down. Convinced of his sincerity, many handed over more cash. The Franklin Syndicate kept growing. Fueled by word of mouth, fabulous returns to new investors, and hundreds of ads in papers throughout the country, Miller spent upwards of $32,000 making sure the ads went out regularly, interspersing self-placed media coverage with headlines that wouldn't be out of place in any modern clickbait forum, like Wall Street Astonished, William F. Miller's Franklin Syndicate a Big Winner, Financial Operations Eclipsed by a New Wizard. The business flourished. By November, Franklin had over 12,000 subscribers, and each day between $20,000 and $63,000 was deposited into his account by new eagers. The lines stretched down the stairs, out the door, serpentining around Floyd Street. You could see the lucky ones who'd already gotten their dividends descending down the stairs, satisfied smiles on their faces, and you would jostle just a bit closer for your own chance. One crisp winter morning, the line had grown so thick that the stoop of 144 Floyd collapsed. The office, too, had turned sleek and professional. 2 roll-top desks, a large table with impressive-looking circulars professing the Franklin Syndicate's prowess, a wooden railing down the middle to separate the deposits from the returns. To the right, a small booth with a glass window through which to pay investors their dividends. Piles of bills, gold and silver coin lining the shelves for all to see. It made a pretty picture. By November 24th, Miller's deposits closed in on $1.2 million. In 1988, Shelley Taylor, a psychologist at the University of California at Los Angeles, proposed that humans have a strong bias toward misperceiving the world. We don't just think ourselves exceptional, we predict our lives will always go well, better than before even. We are programmed, in a sense, to think a bit too positively about how things will turn out, even the things we have no actual control over. It's a tendency known as the positivity bias or optimistic bias, and it is a version of our belief in our own exceptionalism, but one that centers on our life outcomes. How we'll fare, how things will go for us, the extent to which we control our environment and the events that transpire therein. Even pessimists experience it. It's optimism not about the world or people in general, but about yourself. The most sour skeptic still thinks he will come out on top. One of the key elements of the convincer, the next stage of the confidence game, is that it is, well, convincing. The convincer makes it seem like you're winning and everything is going according to plan. You're getting money on your investment. Your wrinkles are disappearing and your weight's dropping. That doctor really seems to know what he's doing. That wine really is exceptional and that painting exquisite. You sure know how to find the elusive deal. The horse you bet on, both literal and figurative, is coming in a winner. The tale made us fully aware of our own exceptional nature. We are good and we deserve great things. And lo and behold, precisely that now seems to transpire. We are indeed justified in putting our initial trust in the game. That 10% return is coming in strong, just as promised. No self-respecting con artist is complete fluff. There needs to be something real there to anchor the whole thing. Just for a moment, the grifter needs his mark to feel as if he is holding a winning ticket. Glafira Rosales, the master art fraud perpetrator, had some legitimate paintings in the midst of the dozens of fakes she dumped on the market. Rudy Kernuan and Hardy Rodenstock, the wine forgers par excellence, the first convicted, the second still alleged, threw lavish dinners where the fine wines they served were quite real. All Ponzi schemes, of course, work until they don't. And so on. We are terrible at predicting the future. It's unpredictable by definition, true, but that doesn't keep us from thinking it isn't. When things are going well, we tend to think they will continue doing so, and quite possibly even improve. We tend to think, as Taylor puts it, that the present is better than the past, and that the future will be even better. When Americans were surveyed about their thoughts on the future, most expressed confidence in continued improvement. In one study, when college students were asked to list future possibilities for their lives and careers, the positive outcomes outnumbered the negative 4-1. In effect, most people seem to be saying, "The future will be great, especially for me," Taylor explains. When it comes to our own lives, we tend to be especially certain that good things are coming our way and bad things will avoid us, especially if an event is hard to forecast with certainty. We become unrealistically optimistic about events that have to do with us. I'll definitely be able to get this book done before the deadline. Nothing stands in my way. And we become unrealistically optimistic that we'll avoid any obstacles. Really? Nothing will stand in my way? In 1990, psychologist Robert Vallone and his colleagues asked students to make 41 predictions about themselves in the coming semester. The list involved things like joining a fraternity or sorority, visiting San Francisco, playing a sport, voting in the November election, dropping courses, studying more than 2 hours a day, having a higher GPA in certain subjects, having a steady boyfriend or girlfriend, calling their parents at least 5 times, changing career goals, changing political affiliation, making post-graduation school or job plans, feeling homesick, continuing in a bad relationship, and so on. Some of the predictions were positive, others slightly more negative. At the end of the semester, the researchers once more caught up with the students to see how it had all played out. On 29 of the predictions, or 70%, the students had been overconfident by at least 10%. That is, there was a 10% or more difference between what actually happened and what they had predicted would happen. On another 8 items, the gap was over 20%. And the confidence error was always in the students' favor. They were much more likely to think positive events would take place and that they would manage to avoid negative ones than was actually the case. For instance, they had predicted with almost full confidence, 80 to 85%, that they would remain with a long-distance love through the end of the semester. Their actual accuracy? A coin toss or worse. Ralph Raines Jr. was the heir to a large tree farm in Gaston, Oregon, a family fortune valued at $15.5 million. In 2004, when he was 57, the confirmed bachelor decided to visit a fortune teller in nearby Bend, Rachel Lee of Lee's Psychic Shop. He liked what he heard, so much so that for the next 2 years he made regular visits to Lee's storefront for further consultations. He felt he could trust this woman. She had suffered a great deal in her life. She'd lost a husband to cancer, and she seemed honest and earnest. When Raines's father suffered a stroke in October 2006, he had the perfect idea. He would hire Lee as his full-time health worker. She had, after all, taken care of her husband for years. Lee started work at almost $9,000 a month. Her boyfriend, Blancy, was hired to fix up the property. By the time Raines Sr. died, his son had given Lee power of attorney. Lee started buying real estate. Psychic shops in several towns. A house. It would be, she told Raines, a perfect way to realize investment gains. She had previously worked in real estate, she told him. He trusted her advice implicitly. And then, in 2007, she upped the stakes. She introduced Raines to her teenage daughter, Portia. Except to Raines, she was Mary Marks, a complete stranger. For the role, she donned a blonde wig, his preferred hair color, affected a British accent, and arranged a chance encounter. Raines remembers it well. October 21st, 2007. He had been at a tree farm convention and had asked Lee to pick him up from the airport. She told him to meet her in the smoking area. And there, on one of the chairs, was a striking blonde who addressed him by name. She sometimes got vibes from people, she explained, and she was getting a strong psychic reading from him. Personal facts, even his birth date. The information just seemed to flow from her psychic channels. Raines was completely smitten. He asked her name. Mary Marks, she said, a part-time bookkeeper. They made plans to meet for coffee. Their friendship soon deepened. In time, Marks Naley confided a secret. She was illegal and would soon be deported. Raines agreed to marry her, and she proceeded to provide him with legal papers to sign. All fake, it would turn out. By November 2010, Raines's house had been transferred into Marks's name. And then came the kicker. Marks wanted a child. Would Raines agree to in vitro fertilization? He would. He remembers her bringing him a large pot with dried ice inside and instructing him to place his donation inside. As far as Raines was concerned, she would give the sperm to a California clinic for the procedure. Marks, in the meantime, had other plans. She really was pregnant by another man. When the boy was born, she named him Giorgio Armani. She insisted he was Raines' son. Rachel Lee would serve as his nanny. In 2012, Marks asked for a second donation. Raines happily obliged. He was proud of his growing family and eager to welcome a new arrival. This time, though, Marks faked her pregnancy, wearing padding to simulate the baby bump around the time it was expected to show. And then she called with the devastating news. Gloria Jean, Raines had already picked out a name, was no more. She had had a miscarriage. Raines was devastated. But why the fake second child?